This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Hi, everybody. I'm Dr. David Granite, and welcome to Health Matters. I'm going to give you a line that our next guest has said, which I love: being careful but inclusive. What are we talking about? Well, in this case, food allergies. And to get us through food allergies, we have with us an expert, Dr. Stephanie Leonard, who is director of the Food Allergy Center at Rady Children's Hospital here in San Diego. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. I saw some data that kind of blew my mind a little bit because I had no idea how extensive this all is. More than 3 million kids under the age of 18 were diagnosed with food allergies last year or have food allergies. Every 3 minutes, somebody goes to the emergency room with an allergy-related event. That's a huge number of people being affected by this.
It is, and we do, about 4 to 6% of children are diagnosed with food allergy, and we see that number increasing. Over about a 10-year period, there was an increase of 18% in children under the age of 18 who were diagnosed with food allergy.
Well, I want to ask you about that, but I think first we have to start off with something as a little bit more basic. What is food allergy? What does that mean?
Right. So there's so many different types of reactions or adverse reactions you can have to food. But when we talk about food allergy, we're specifically talking about the type where you're at risk for anaphylaxis, which is a severe allergic reaction that could be life-threatening. And that's where the immune system in the body recognizes the protein in a food and reacts against it.
So if I eat something and I get sick, is that the same as a food allergy? I mean, I can't drink milk. I'm lactose intolerant. Is that a food allergy, or are we talking about something different?
So that's different. So lactose intolerance is where you can't digest the sugar in the milk, but if you're milk allergic, your body reacts to the protein in the milk. So for example, you can't drink lactate because it still has the protein in it, but if you're lactose intolerant, you could probably tolerate that.
And what is the person who has the food allergy experience?
So when you have a food allergic reaction, after you eat the food, within 30 minutes up to 2 hours, you get immediate symptoms. And that can be rash, itching, hives, swelling, vomiting, diarrhea, difficulty breathing, or coughing.
None of those sound good.
Not at all.
So you were talking about how many people are impacted, but that it's on the rise. It seems like all forms of allergy are on the rise. Why is that happening?
It's a great question. There are many theories. The most popular one is the hygiene theory, which says that we are so sterile in our lives that the part of the immune system that used to fight off parasites is now attacking things that it shouldn't be attacking. However, this theory has been around for 10, 20 years, and we haven't been able to prove it, so it's actually starting to fall to the wayside. And there are other theories about how we process our food, pollutions or pollutants in our environment, vitamin D levels. There's so many different theories that people are talking about now.
So I don't have to tell my kids they should eat dirt, just to prevent this.
Right. We have no proof that we can actually do that.
Okay. So we have somebody who is eating something. They have this funky reaction. How young do parents start noticing this?
We can see it as young as the first year, the first week of life with, for example, milk formula. The theory is that your body has to see the food once at least before it reacts to it. And we see kids in infancy that we test and we diagnose with food allergy, and they even can have life-threatening reactions.
So if a parent thinks their child may be having a food allergy, what do they do? Who do they go to? And what happens to them when they go there?
Well, the first step, if you think your child is having an allergic reaction, you want to either contact your pediatrician, the nurse's line, or take them to the ER because you want to treat that immediately. The first thing you're going to reach for is an antihistamine, which you can get over the counter at a pharmacy. The next step is that you do want to contact your pediatrician and see if it's appropriate if you need to be seen by an allergist or certain testing that we can do to confirm the food allergy. Food allergy reactions can be confused with a lot of different things. In kids, probably the number one thing it's confused with is having a virus. The number one cause of rash in kids is a virus. And so you'll have someone, for example, let's say a kid eats strawberries for the first time Saturday morning. Sunday morning, wakes up with a rash and fever. Parents may wonder, was it the strawberry? Did I give them something that made this happen? But a fever is not a symptom of an allergic reaction. So I start to think, A, it's 24 hours later. It may be something else. And B, do they have other symptoms like a runny nose, or is somebody sick in the family? Could this be a viral illness and not a food reaction?
So take care of the emergent thing right in front of you.
Yes.
If your child's having trouble breathing or something really swelling up in front of you, you can give them an antihistamine, but not to wait too long before going to get immediate care.
If there's any respiratory difficulty or they're vomiting so much they can't keep down the antihistamine, then you're dialing 911.
Got it. And then you end up in your, eventually in your pediatrician's office and maybe at your office mm-hmm. to get testing. What is the testing like for a child going through this?
Mm-hmm. So there's two types of testing. One is skin testing. One is blood testing. Your pediatrician can do blood testing, but I still recommend that you see an allergist to confirm it because not everybody can interpret those results correctly. There are a lot of false positives. Sometimes there are false negatives, which means the test may be negative, but you're pretty sure your child reacted to something. You would want to go ahead and see an allergist and get a skin testing to confirm that.
And then what is skin testing? What does that look like?
Skin testing, it's what we call a scratch test. Some people use a little plastic tip. Others use just a little metal prong. And there is a liquid at the tip of it that contains the protein that you may be allergic to. Skin is scratched, and we wait to see if there a little bump develops on the skin that tells us that your body's reacting to it.
Kids let you do this?
Yes. We often need, obviously, cooperation with, and parents help us out all the time. It's done very quickly, and we try to make sure that they're comfortable. So if it's a little bit itchy afterwards, we'll put some cream on, or we'll give them some antihistamines in the office if they're very itchy. But we don't expect them to have a reaction, a full body reaction from the skin testing, just a local skin reaction.
And if you've tested negative once and you're three, does that mean you're negative forever? And if you've tested positive, does that mean you're positive forever?
Not always. So younger children have less skin reactivity in their skin. So sometimes if the story's real, for me, the story is the most important thing. If the story is real and even the skin testing is negative, there's one more thing that we could do, and that's to do a food challenge in the office.
Have them eat the food.
Right. It's a very controlled setting. We watch them eat the food, and then we watch them for 2 hours after to make sure they're okay. Or we confirm the allergy because they start to have symptoms.
But
this is something that I don't recommend doing at home. You have to do it in a controlled setting in a doctor's office.
It could be scary otherwise.
Right.
Now, the most common things that I came across, milk, eggs, peanuts, soy, wheat, tree nuts, fish, and shellfish.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of the food we eat all the time. That's a lot of the food that kids eat all the time.
Right. And I would add one more too. Sesame.
Okay.
It's kind of like the new number nine. Yeah.
Okay.
If you look around the world, which countries have different, we all have different types of food allergies, like the most common. For example, in Singapore, bird's nest is a common food allergy, and it's because they eat that in their diet. So it's not, I don't think it's surprising that it's the foods that we're most exposed to, which are the ones that people are allergic to.
Makes sense. So I'm just trying to think about a family where a child's been diagnosed with a serious food allergy to one of those items. And they've got to live their life now. So I'm trying to picture what that looks like. How they eliminate something accurately from your diet when it's sometimes hard to find out what's in things. And then how they're prepared in case the child does get exposed to something. What does that look like for the family? How much does this change their life and how do they go about doing it?
It definitely affects their daily life, absolutely. We eat at least 3 times a day. Every time their child eats, they have to think about it. One good thing is that we do have a law now that says that the top 8 most common food allergies are labeled in plain English on packaging. So anything you buy from the store, it needs to become an automatic thing where you just flip it over and you read it. You read the ingredients, and then sometimes there's a warning at the bottom that says in plain English, this contains wheat, soy, egg, etc.
And the child needs to figure that out because they're going to be at Timmy's house, and Timmy's mom gives them something
right.
they need to know.
Not only does the family need to change the way that they handle food or meals, but whenever a child goes to someone's house to play or to eat dinner, then that has to be communicated to the friend's parents. So it's not only about educating the parents of the patient, it's about educating all the caregivers, daycare, school, friends, relatives. It's pretty extensive, and it's something that we're really trying to do to get the word out there.
My children's schools all have a peanut-free table.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have an egg-free table. They don't have a wheat-free table. They don't have a shellfish-free table.
Right.
So the child with the peanut allergy has to sit at that table.
Right.
So they're segregated, but at least somewhat protected,
mm-hmm.
Assuming that some kid with a peanut butter and jelly sandwich hasn't sat down there.
Mm-hmm.
But if you get on an airplane, they hand out peanuts. Mm-hmm. How do you actually protect your child, and how worried should parents be of the incidental exposure?
Right. So, again, that's finding the balance between protecting your kids but letting them live their lives. I would love to go back to the school, the peanut table. Yes, it's absolutely true. You can have a milk allergy, an egg allergy, and you can have as severe of a reaction to those foods as you can to peanut. We do see more kids having more severe reactions with peanut, but it doesn't mean that you can't have a severe reaction with another food. The other thing is that the peanut-free table is something that I think we need to rethink. You know, a child who has a food allergy, it's not their choice. It's biological, genetic. And to imagine that that child has to sit away from his friends on a daily basis is not the best thing for his psychosocial health, for his or her psychosocial health. So we're actually now advocating having peanut tables. If you bring a peanut butter and jelly sandwich to school that day, you sit at the peanut table so that the child who has a food allergy doesn't get ostracized on a daily basis for the rest of their school life.
And the person who makes the choice to bring a peanut, then it's their choice to sit at the table.
Correct.
And the person who doesn't have the choice, the peanut allergy,
correct,
isn't ostracized.
Yes.
That's great. So this goes back to your being careful but inclusive.
Right.
And so there's something that I came across that I got alerted to in preparing for this show that you have to talk to me about. The idea of food allergy and bullying.
Right.
I'm astonished that this can occur.
Right. There was a recent study out that showed that more than 50% of children with food allergy reported being bullying at some point at school because of their food allergy.
How does that happen?
Well, on top of everything else, you know, it just adds one more thing that someone can taunt another child about or make them feel different. And certainly, if you put them at a peanut-free table, that kind of alerts everybody else that there's something different about them. Food allergy is different than other chronic diseases. You can't see on the outside what's going on. And so it's hard for people to understand that they need to be safe, but at the same time, you don't want to ostracize them.
So do kids threaten other kids with their allergic food?
So unfortunately, yes. A lot of the threats involve either waving the food at them, throwing the food at them.
Like taking a sandwich and going, no, no, no.
Yeah, absolutely. Gosh. And so not only do you have the psychosocial effects of that, but you have a physical health threat.
Absolutely. That's. You might as well be waving a knife or something.
Right. And some parents try to describe that. They try to educate other parents and say, you know, what if there is something that your child... For me, peanut is like poison to my child.
Right.
And so can you put yourself in my shoes and see how scary that can be to send my kid off to school and have this happen to them?
That's frightening.
Right. Absolutely.
Truly frightening. Wow.
Unfortunately, about 10%... in that survey, kids reported that 10% of the bullying was done either by a staff or by a teacher. And that is really disheartening.
Yes.
You know,
wow.
Making the kid feel bad or feeling like they're being annoying because they have this problem. And so, again, shows us that we have a lot to do to teach the public and day caregivers and school teachers and staff.
Wow. So the kids have to be aware, everybody's aware. What happens if they do get the allergic response and they're not in a physician's office? What does the child have to carry around with them? What does the school have to have prepared? How do we treat this?
So I teach my patients they should always have a food allergy action plan. So that's actually written instructions on if someone has this symptom, you give them this. If someone has this symptom, you give them this. You call 911 and what they're allergic to. Then they need to have an antihistamine, and then they need to have an injectable epinephrine. Injectable epinephrine is the medication. It is a shot. It goes in the leg, but it is a life-saving medication that actually stops the allergic reaction. So at school, which is the place that most kids are at besides home, the school nurse should have those three things in the nurse's office, and the teacher should be aware of the allergies in the classroom. Every school's a little bit different. Every school district's a little bit different. But one thing that we are doing in the United States, there's several states now, including California, that has a law where we can have what we call generic injectable epinephrine in the nurse's office, which means if a child with an unknown food allergy has a sudden reaction at school,
they can
actually go ahead and use it and treat the child and save their life.
That's important.
It's absolutely important.
So dealing with children, this question always comes up. Parents who think they did something wrong to create this during
right.
the pregnancy or somehow they used the wrong formula. Are food allergies because parents have done something wrong?
No, we can't say that. We have no idea, unfortunately, exactly why kids are getting food allergy. I get that question all the time. There are just as many studies that show that women who ate a lot of peanuts during pregnancy seem to increase the risk of food allergy, and there's just as many show that it seems to decrease the risk of food allergy. So we don't have any good recommendations right now for pregnancy, and what we say is in moderation. Everything in moderation. And then if your child does start to show signs of allergy, for example, eczema, eczema is an allergic disease, and sometimes we see that before the food allergy comes. If your child or infant or baby has any of those signs, that you do want to talk to your pediatrician about it, we may give some different advice about how you're introducing foods to that child.
Is this genetic?
We absolutely think there's a genetic component. We also think there's an environmental component because the increase of food allergy has happened too fast to account just for changes in the genetics. So we do believe that there is something going on in the environment. We just haven't been able to pinpoint it. It may be a combination of factors. It may depend on where you grow up even. There's an interesting study that shows that children from immigrant parents who come to the United States are actually at higher risk for food allergy. Hmm. We're trying to figure out what that is. You know, we have grandparents from other countries who say, we don't have food allergy in our country. What are you talking about? And it's hard for them to understand what it is. And so why are they protected there? And then they come here. What's different here?
Wow.
And that's why, you know, a lot of people are pointing to environmental exposures, either pollution or how we process our food. They're all very intriguing theories, but we haven't been able to pinpoint one.
So parents don't really cause it. They can't really prevent it. They just can deal with it when it occurs. What's the horizon in the future of what we'd like to see going on that can change this? What are the different treatments to try and not just, oh my God, you're expanding right in front of me, let me use an EpiPen, but what are the other treatment options or thought processes that we have going forward?
So one important thing is that there are several foods that kids are likely to outgrow. So milk, egg, soy, wheat, at least with milk and egg, we know 80% of kids outgrow that. So you do want to constantly, we want them retested. I usually see kids in my office once a year to retest their allergy. There are other food allergies that are harder to outgrow. So that's peanut and tree nuts and fish and shellfish. And for those, we're really seeing a concentrated effort to do clinical trials in food allergy therapy. And that's trying to decrease their sensitivity to the food so that they don't have to worry so much about accidentally eating it. So that is a form of protection that we're trying to give to these children. And the other thing is that we are trying to come up with good recommendations on what are things that may be able to prevent food allergy. So the American Academy of Pediatrics used to have guidelines that said you should delay certain allergy foods like milk and egg and peanut to a certain age. And we found that while we were doing that, the rise of food allergy continued. We didn't think it was actually helping, so now that recommendation is gone. There are a lot of people still out there that are adhering to these guidelines, and we don't think it's helpful. And now we're trying to see, is it possible that there are certain windows of time when you should introduce these foods that may actually prevent it? We don't have the answers yet. It's probably different for each food, but that's something that researchers are working on, and we hope to be able to give better recommendations in the future.
Sure. The desensitization. That concept, allergy shots, desensitization, has been around for a long time.
Right.
Is it different than it used to be? Are you currently doing desensitization, or is that all in clinical trial?
It's all in clinical trial. It's not FDA approved yet. The idea is to give someone a very small amount and kind of build their way up over time to a point where their body stops reacting to it. And that concept has been around for 100 years. Most people know allergy shots for environmental allergies. We tried to do that for food allergies, and we saw a lot of severe reactions. So getting the shots for food allergy therapy is not something we're looking at anymore. And instead, we found other ways of giving it to them. So it's either oral, so they drink it or swallow it, under the tongue, that's sublingual. And now the newest one is what we call, it's a patch on the skin, so it's through the skin, and that's called epicutaneous. And so these are three forms that are all currently in clinical trials. The problem and the reason why it hasn't come to the clinic, why it hasn't come to the public yet, is that, A, there are a lot of side effects. It's not something that we want people trying at home. It has to be in a controlled environment. And B, it isn't one way to do it. So we don't have a standardized way to do it. So if the FDA hasn't been able to approve one way.
Don't want parents at home giving your child a peanut today, two peanuts tomorrow, peanuts the next day.
No, and the issue is that if for example, someone is being exposed to a small amount and they're actually having reactions, there's a possibility that you could be making it worse. So this needs to be under a very controlled setting. And it's something that we do, it's very scientific, you know, down to the milligrams of peanut protein that we're giving someone. So we don't encourage it absolutely at home because we think that would be dangerous. We know, we understand the desire to have something like that, to either have a cure, to have a treatment that will keep them safe. And we need more time to make sure that what we're going to propose or what we're going to give out to our patients is safe and that it works.
I would imagine parents are pushing you.
Yes, and I would love to be able to give them something, and I see this on a daily basis, and I want to protect them, and we want a cure. I mean, that is everyone's goal in the food allergy community. And right now, we know that this therapy works, but again, there are a lot of issues around it, and that includes side effects. So it's something that we're working very hard to do, very hard on.
So if I'm a parent, I see you once a year. Mm-hmm. You're fabulous giving information, but in between, I want to keep up to date. I want to get information. You and I were talking earlier about the use of social networks for dissemination of information to parents. Tell me about that.
Absolutely. There are some great websites that parents can go on to and talk to other parents. There were two good food allergy groups in the country that were, patient-driven that have now combined. It's called FAIR. It's Food Allergy Research and Education. And they're a really driving force for the research, but also providing people who are in cities that aren't around food allergy centers for getting information to them. And I highly suggest their website. It's foodallergy.org. And there's another website where there's a lot of parent boards, which are constantly monitored because you go on the internet and you find so much information that could lead you down the wrong road.
Absolutely.
I think one of the biggest problems if you search for food allergy on the internet is that people call different things all food allergy. That could be food intolerance. That could be, is food affecting my behavior? Is food affecting my stomach? And I think that sometimes leads to a lot of confusion. It makes it harder for the public to understand what's going on and which ones are really life-threatening, which aren't.
Yeah, and that's why we started with what is a food allergy, because right. We're not talking about foods that make your child have ADD. I mean, that's a completely different issue and a different story altogether from
right.
what we've been talking about
right.
today. And people need to be clear about that. You also told me that you Twitter or tweet. I probably
right.
got that wrong.
So there's a small food allergy research community out there, and we've all trained at a lot of the same places, and we all are trying to get this information out to our patients and to the public. And so there are many Facebook pages for food allergy centers in the country and Twitter feeds as well. And so things that I post are things that I think would be useful for my patient to know about. There is a new, injectable epinephrine that just came out, and what is that about, and should I get it or should I not? Whenever results come out from research studies, we try to disseminate that. We really need to focus on bullying in school. We really need to focus on vigilance, because there was a study that came out recently about looking at kids in preschool kids and how many once the food allergy has been diagnosed, how many reactions they have. And it was an astonishing to see that there were so many reactions happening, even when they've been diagnosed already. And a lot of that had to do with vigilance, reading, forgetting to pick up the package and reading the ingredients.
Yeah.
And we understand that, but it also was very enlightening because it showed us that 30% of the time it happened when the kids weren't with parents. So now we know we need to educate those caregivers. We need to educate the relatives. We need to educate everybody else.
That's sort of the hard work of medicine. It's not the miracle splashy stuff on the front page of the New York Times. It's the hard work each day.
Right. And so that kind of information, getting it out to our patients also helps. And so those are the type of things that I post.
In the very short time we have left, I'm just wondering if you gave us a vision of the world according to you. What would happen next? Where would we go?
For me, the two most important things are looking for a cure. And making sure that my patients are safe. And so teaching them how to respond to a reaction if it happens. Because, you know, sometimes accidents do happen. But if you're prepared, that is the most important thing. And not to be scared about the injectable epinephrine. That's something I'm working on. Needle phobia is an important issue. So I encourage my patients to talk to an allergist because that's where the education is going to happen. To be prepared if a reaction happens. To not blame themselves that their kids have the food allergy. We really don't know, we are recruiting patients for clinical trials here at Rady Children's, and the more people, the more studies that we can do, I think the more progress we're going to make. And 10 years already, in the last 10 years, they've been doing the oral desensitization. We've learned an immense amount of information about food allergy that was never thought to exist before. Most people thought you got diagnosed with food allergy and you had it for the rest of your life, and we're trying to change that.
Well, thank you so much for being here today, but thank you more importantly for all the work that you're doing each and every day. You've been listening to Dr. Stephanie Leonard, an expert on food allergies, and once again, I'm struck by how much knowledge is power. The more you know about your health, the more you can make a difference, and food allergies not only is no exception, it's the rule. You have to know about this to be able to take care of your child in this circumstance. It really makes a difference. See your allergist, talk to your pediatrician, get information. I'm Dr. David Granite. We'll see you again next time right here on Health Matters.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.